It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Penn State's president has told the university community an investigation into the Facebook posting of nude photographs by a now suspended fraternity could lead to a reevaluation of the overall fraternity system. But a recent Penn Live report says Pennsylvania's top victims advocate is chiding PSU President Eric Barron for having delayed publicly weighing in on the fraternity scandal that once again has Penn State under national scrutiny for possible sexual misconduct. I'm joined now by phone by Penn Live reporter Evie DeJesus. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
You talked to Jennifer Storm, victim advocate of the Commonwealth. Evie, what did she have to say about how the Penn State president has responded to this scandal?
Jennifer was, frankly, she very stern words for Eric Barron. She felt that he had dropped the ball in not coming out quicker. Speaking out publicly on this, she thought that the message needed to come from him, needed to come from the very top leadership, and that it shouldn't have been delegated down to, you know, the various offices, the Office of Student Conduct, as well as the IFC, the Interfraternity Council. So she was very clear about it. She thought that, you know, given the history of Penn State and the challenges that it's had in recent years, with regards to handling of sexual misconduct, she just thought that it was really mishandled at that point. You know, he did come out eventually this week, but up until then, she just thought that it was sending the wrong message.
How much of her criticism of Eric Barron for not being more proactive in his approach to this situation in the wake of what happened with this particular fraternity ties back to his tenure at Florida State when sexual misconduct on behalf of that school's football team's star quarterback, there was some criticism about how he handled that particular situation where he had to answer to charges that the school had mishandled that rape investigation involving that particular quarterback under his watch.
Right. And certainly that's always been part of the conversation ever since Mr. Barron arrived at Penn State. I think, however, that, you know, the more immediate factor was the Oklahoma situation, was, you know, this comparison, and there was a lot of conversation here and there, not only within the media, but even on campus, and I think even the Daily Collegiate had something to say about that Oklahoma University President David Boren came out immediately after the Sigma Alpha Epsilon matter, broke. He spoke out and, was very, very involved in it. And people were waiting for Eric Barron to, I think, do the same. I think he's always been under that spotlight, from the Florida events. But I think in this instance, perhaps more so, it's this Oklahoma situation, the comparison to the way that the Oklahoma University president handled that.
For his part, Mr. Barron is saying that he's working with police to determine the number of offenders. To be fair to him, is he limited perhaps in what he can say and do at this point? Because I guess in the Oklahoma case, you had a situation that was much more clear. In both situations, you have video evidence. But the video evidence, it was very clear about what happened on that bus involving those fraternity brothers in Oklahoma. Clearly, something very bad has happened at Penn State, but it seems as though the police are still kind of sifting through exactly what occurred.
Clearly. I mean, there was real audio and visual evidence with the Oklahoma situation. The Penn State situation is still very much under investigation. I think all the officials, all the administration officials have been very cautious not to compromise that investigation. And he has articulated as much, that there are two very different circumstances. So he felt the comparison has been unfair.
And Kappa Delta Rho has been suspended for a year amid an investigation. And again, this is into whether this is an investigation into two members only Facebook pages that featured photos of nude and partially nude women, some in sexual positions. Some of the women appeared to be unconscious. The police, as they sift through this, they said in court documents, you reported this, some of the women photographed appeared to be aware their pictures were taken. Others did not. The fraternity has been suspended for a year. Could Mr. Barron have come out and done what happened in Oklahoma and said, that's it, we're cutting all ties to this fraternity forever?
Well, he could have. Jennifer Storm even said that she would have pulled a charter pending the investigation. They've been suspended, so they've been pretty much the members are not able to participate in any sort of extracurricular activities, any sports activities or clubs or anything like that. They've been suspended not only by their national charter, but also the Interfraternity Council has suspended them. So I think they're just being cautious. I think that, they want to, and I think understandably so. We just don't know how many individuals were involved. And I think they're just being cautious that, don't lump everyone, don't convict anyone before anyone's found guilty.
Right. So when Mr. Barron says, for example, he's been very critical of the media's coverage of this incident. As a member of the media, as someone who is covering this, is his criticism fair? Because what he seems to be saying is, I need to get at the bottom of this before I can do anything drastic.
Yeah, I understand his sentiment, and you certainly hear that on campus a lot. Everyone, there's a fierce allegiance to Penn State. If you are connected to Penn State, whether you're a student or faculty or staff there, there's that allegiance. And I think there's a sense since the, in the post-Sandusky world, there's a sense that Penn State's always held under this very negative light, and that the media only likes to focus on, these negative aspects that come out and not all the amazing, wonderful things that happen, that goes on campus. So I understand. I can't speak for him, but he has to grasp the severity of this, the severity of what this means, in terms of victims, these women who've been victimized. He has, Eric Barron has stressed that, we should focus on the individuals and the actions of the individuals and not the fraternities themselves. So he's been very clear about not blaming the entire fraternity institution on Penn State. There's, 50 chapters, I think, at the university. So I think he sees the value, and he's spoken about the noble intentions of these fraternities. So he's very clear about, going after the individuals and not necessarily the entire system. Having said that, though, he's already, I think it was yesterday that he said that, he and senior members of the administration are looking at possibly reevaluating, the system, the fraternity system, and who knows what that means. There's been calls for, you hear it everywhere, people calling for the banning of fraternities, they're kind of the bastion of, bad behavior. So it was interesting to hear him say, it's time to reevaluate this.
We are talking with Penn Live reporter Evie DeJesus about the scandal unfolding at Penn State, an investigation that has rocked the university community into the Facebook posting of nude photographs by a now-suspended fraternity that could, as Evie just mentioned, lead to a reevaluation of the overall fraternity system. And Penn State President Eric Barron has been criticized for having delayed publicly weighing in on the fraternity scandal. And Evie, Penn State has worked to position itself as a leader among colleges and universities that have put in place rigorous standards to prevent sexual violence and resources to respond to victims. how much does this fraternity scandal set those efforts back?
I'm not sure that it's set it back. I spoke to dozens of students on campus this week, both the undergraduates and the graduate students, and they all say that there has definitely been a noticeable change in culture since the Sandusky saga. I think Daily, I hope I'm correct in remembering that, Daily reports of any assault, any sort of, crime. And that's very much in the forefront, students say. There's a lot of initiatives to have people involved, becoming aware of sexual misconduct and inappropriate behavior. Having said that, though, I spoke to a lot of freshmen who say that this party culture is just so rampant and entrenched. And in particular, the fraternities are just kind of dangerous grounds. And I use dangerous as a word that somebody used in a quote to me, that they just stay away from them because, the minute they walk in a fraternity party, it's just, all bets are off. And there are young women who are saying that, the minute they step into a fraternity, they become an object. And it's really troubling to hear some of the accounts of some of those parties. So in the case of Kappa, Delta Rho, KDR, and then I think a lot of these fraternities, these are privately owned houses. So the university itself doesn't have jurisdiction over the houses, which is different from Oklahoma, I believe. So it's really state college police that has, sort of this law enforcement jurisdiction over them. You certainly have the student component, the governance on the student, component, but not the fraternity itself, the house itself.
And there seem to be a lot of people who, as you alluded to, there are students that are upset. Apparently there's a demonstration that's going to be taking place there today.
I think as we speak, there's a rally at noon. So as we speak today on the steps of Old Main, and I think several hundred people had RSVP'd to the Facebook page. I think the rally's called We Are Taking a Stand.
And you referred earlier to, and it's impossible not to, the whole Sandusky scandal. At a university that has prided itself on being at the forefront of sexual assault and harassment in the wake of that scandal, does Penn State are they held to a higher standard here? Does Penn State have to appear to be, do they have to be, or at least appear to be especially proactive in a case like this, like the fraternity video scandal?
I think that's what Jennifer was referring to. Jennifer Storm was saying that, because of their history, because of what they've been through with Jerry Sandusky, that, really he needed to, Eric Barron needed to at least, show that this is not going to be tolerated. I'm not saying that he hasn't said that it's not going to be tolerated, but because of that history, that there's just no room for any gray area.
So where do things...
I think that in general, the victims' advocates have tipped their hats off to Penn State. They really have been very proactive in the aftermath of the Jerry Sandusky case, putting in place numerous programs, and including the task force, which delivered its 18 recommendations just last month in February. So this, it's really quite amazing that this actually was happening as Eric Barron was announcing these recommendations that he was going to put in place to further, address and change this culture of student sexual misconduct.
So where does this investigation go from here? What do you see happening next?
Well, as you said in the program, they have, I believe, two victims that have been identified, and exactly get that right. Two victims or two individuals that they're questioning. I apologize. The past 3 days have been sort of 24/7. Police are being very cautious about what they're saying. That they are very, very confident that the computer forensics are going to lead them to the individuals responsible. As we know, these computer forensics can be so sophisticated. So they're looking at the GPS on telephones and computers, and that, you know, they are able to glean the location and the date and, you know, and the computer that originated the photograph. So the assistant chief of police at State College has already said that they're pretty certain that the indoor photographs were taken at KDR. Not really, he didn't elaborate how they knew that, but they're fairly confident that it was the house, the fraternity house. So again, the police are talking about misdemeanor charges, harassment, invasion of privacy, but they're very quick to couch that, you know, we could be looking at very severe criminal charges as well.
Penn Live reporter Evie DeJesus joining us talking about the situation at Penn State and the scandal involving an investigation into the Facebook postings of nude photographs by a now suspended fraternity on the Penn State campus. Evie DeJesus, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, Oscar-winning director Jonathan Demme returns to the scene of the crime, to the Carnegie Mellon University International Film Festival in Pittsburgh, where he made The Silence of the Lambs. A conversation with Jonathan Demme next on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
Starling.
Well, Clarice, have the lambs stopped screaming?
Dr. Lecter.
Don't bother with the trace. I won't be on long enough.
Where are you, Dr. Lecter?
I have no plans to call on you, Clarice. The world's more interesting with you in it. So you take care now to extend me the same courtesy.
You know I can't make that promise.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner. Bye.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. About a quarter of a century ago, a movie was made in Pittsburgh called Silence of the Lambs. It was a movie that told a terrifying story without green screen, without special effects, without a script that was based in any kind of supernatural lore. It was just a straightforward story about a man who happened to have a habit of eating people, and it won 5 Oscars, including for its director. My guest, Jonathan Demme, who is back in Pittsburgh for the first time since making the film here in the Steel City. Jonathan Demme, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Paul. That was quite a lead-in. And I'm well, thanks. And I'm very excited to be here tonight, you know, at the film festival and back here where we did shoot Silence of the Lambs. But, you know, it's not about a guy who goes around eating people. It's about a young woman who dedicates her life at great personal risk to save the life of another young woman, the gal in the pit. I'm being slightly
played facetious. Brilliantly by Jodie Foster.
Well, Jodie Foster is great as Clarice, and Brooke Smith is the woman she's trying to save, the right. Senator's daughter. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we had a great time living in Pittsburgh, and this is, by the way, it's history because this is like 1990 that we came in here.
Right.
And but we had a blast, and it was great making the movie, and we drew upon the local acting community for some of our key parts, and that was great. So it's exciting. It makes me a little nostalgic to be back here now, to tell you the truth.
What are the memories that you have? What are the things that happened in Pittsburgh when you were making that movie? This city now prides itself on being a place that is open to filmmakers. I don't know if we had it all quite down that well back 25 years ago. What sorts of things did you encounter as you were going about making the film?
Well, you know, I suddenly leapt to George Romero, who, of course, has lived and maybe one of the first people who invented regional cinema. And when we came down here to shoot Silence of the Lambs, because I love the Romero movies, I thought, you know, I've got to call the Pope and get his blessing on shooting a scary movie in his town. So I found George's number and talked to him and said, I need your blessing to shoot here. And he said, you've got it. And then I said, would you do a little cameo? So George Romero came down, and there's a scene in the picture when they've realized that Clarice shouldn't be in the cage talking to Lecter, and they come in, the guards come in to get her. And there's this tall guy, very, very, you know, auspicious guy with a walkie-talkie in his hand, kind of like checking everything out, and that's George Romero.
No kidding. I had no idea until now.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that and grateful to George. But, you know, it was just, we were making a movie in extraordinary locations. And, you know, we knew that the movie was going to be good because the book that it was based upon is such an amazing book. I mean, it's really a great American book. The screenplay reflected the book very accurately, and we didn't try to improve on Thomas Harris's book. So, you know, I remember the one thing, really, my most vivid memory is that we stayed in a house out in Squirrel Hill, and it snowed, and I remember taking my two-year-old daughter for her first sleigh ride, and there were some wonderful hills around there, and we... There was a shed in the house. There was a sled in the house we were renting, and now I'm sleigh riding with my daughter, like right sitting on feet on the handlebars, and it's going faster and faster and faster, and that was the scariest moment of Silence of the Lambs for me. I was thinking, how am I going to stop this thing? So at a certain point, I grabbed her, rolled over before, and watched the sled careen into a fence there at the bottom.
But everybody made it
fine. Everybody was good.
Good. You know, there are always stories about a movie where there is an iconic character that you can only imagine having been played by the person that ends up performing it. But the Scarlett O'Hara comes to mind. Vivian Leigh played her in the movie, but there was the story that they wanted Betty Davis, which some people may find hard to believe or hard to wrap their mind around. With Anthony Hopkins, was there ever any thought to anybody else for that role other than him?
First, everybody wanted to play that part. People that were wrong for one reason or another, but Dustin Hoffman wanted to play Dr. Lecter. Morgan Freeman wanted to play Dr. Lecter. I always felt that that Anthony Hopkins would be great because he was such a good doctor in The Elephant Man. So it's a question of, like, what happens if the good doctor goes bad? You know, I knew that Anthony Hopkins would be the best, but I also knew that he wasn't particularly commercial at that point in his career. And I thought, I imagined that Sean Connery could also probably be great, and that was a more commercial choice. So he was offered the part, and he read it, and word came back that he read 20 pages and thought it was vile and gross, and no way would he ever be in that. And I went, okay, good, I've done my due diligence trying to get a movie star. Let's go get Anthony Hopkins. So I went over to London. He was doing M. Butterfly over there, and he had read the script, and we met, and we really hit it off, felt a very good connection, and he got the part.
Take this thing back to Baltimore.
5'10", strongly built, about 180 pounds. Hair blonde, eyes pale blue. He'd be about 35 now. He said he lived in Philadelphia, but may have lied. That's all I can remember, Mom. But if I think of any more, I will let you know. Oh, and Senator, just one more thing. Love your suit.
Would Philadelphia have been possible without Silence of the Lambs?
I don't think so. I think the fact that Silence of the Lambs was an enormous hit at the box office, and it got great reviews, and it won all those awards. And at that moment, you know, I had a lot of currency, I wanted to do a movie about AIDS. And, you know, I think the fact that coming off of Silence of the Lambs, I think people were ready to gamble on an AIDS movie. You know?
And how much do you think Philadelphia contributed to the evolution of how we talk about AIDS and gay rights in this country and perhaps throughout the world?
Well, all I know for sure really is that Philadelphia touched individuals, and I've had over the years lots of people tell me that they were homophobic and they didn't see their nephew or their brother or their sister or their former best friend before they came out as being gay. And this recurring motif of people being transformed and calling up the nephew and saying, you must come over, and apologizing for that. I've heard countless stories of people in their real life, you know, having this kind of transformation. So to me, that's like amazing, just amazing.
Jonathan Demme, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks a lot, Paul. It was really fun. It's great to meet you.
And from one Oscar winner to another, we're back in Studio A with producer-director Peter Fudukowski, who won an Academy Award in the Best Foreign Film category in 2006. He has brought to the Carnegie Mellon International Film Festival what looks to be a crackling good movie called Secret Sharer, a contemporary romantic thriller set on the South China Sea and inspired by the Joseph Conrad novella. It screens tomorrow evening at 7:15 at McConomy Hall on the CMU campus. Peter Fudukowski, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good morning. Great pleasure to be here.
Great having you. You know, Jonathan Demme is a tough act to follow, but you seem more than capable of handling it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed moderating the Q&A with him yesterday. He's such an interesting man, such an extraordinary body of work that I did feel quite humbled, I have to say.
So at what point did you pick up Secret Sharer or become aware of this story and decide this would make a good film?
A long while ago. I've always been a fan of Joseph Conrad's works. But it was in 2006 when I was in China promoting Tsotsi, the film for which we got the Academy Award. And the Chinese were asking me constantly, when are you going to come to China and make a film? Which is sort of code for when you're going to come and make us an Oscar-winning movie, like you did for South Africa with Tsotsi. So, of course, it appealed to my ego. And my wife, who was with me, said, look, you know, remember that story, that Joseph Conrad short story? If we updated it and set it in a contemporary era at sea, it would make a great piece, actually, because it deals with all sorts of interesting issues and values, which in the West are kind of forgotten, duty and sacrifice and family values and so on. But they're very much present in China still, among all the people we certainly met during our time there. So that was the initial idea. That was the spark that got us going. So I started working on the screenplay and adapting it. In the end, deciding to use it as the original story as an inspiration rather than adaptation.
Right. You end up tweaking and modernizing the story. Did you hear or do you anticipate hearing from any Conrad purists who might say, you know, you really ought not be messing with this classic?
Yes, I did expect to get hammered by the Conradians, but I did take precaution of showing them the film first before anybody else. And most notably, a professor, Gene Moore, is an American, but based in Europe, in Amsterdam, who does know his film and his Conrad. And he tells me there's been over 100 adaptations of Conrad novels and short stories onto film. He's one of the most adapted writers. He's a real draw for filmmakers, you know, from Orson Welles to Francis Ford Coppola. We spent 3 years in China wanting to make it in China, going through the censors, one level by another. After 3 years, we got permission from the Chinese censors or the Ministry of Propaganda. They wrote to us saying, yes, please come make your movie. The money's here, and we'll send you the script in 3 days.
What were the red lights for them?
It was bizarre. It was so bizarre. It's not about ideology or even censorship. It's about control. Mm-hmm. And it was so silly in the end that I had to withdraw.
Well, fortunately, the movie was made. Without giving too much away, tell us about the story, because it's quite good.
It's an interesting story, but that's not the most interesting aspect of it. But very simply put, it's about a young captain whose dream it is to become get his first command on a merchant marine ship. It's a cargo ship. And he gets what he dreams of, but it's not quite what he expected. He gets command from his Chinese boss of an old Chinese rust bucket that's really effectively going to the scrapyard, but it's not entirely clear what the deal is, because he gets paid a lot more money than he should be for this task. He gets onto the ship to find a recalcitrant old crew who really don't trust him and like him. And they set sail. And when they get to China from the Gulf of Thailand, a few days later, they abandon ship. The crew abandon ship at night, leaving him alone on this 100-meter-long ship. That night, the young captain, kind of lost, doesn't know what to do, decides he's got to pull up the rope ladder for security reasons. As he's pulling it up, he looks overboard and finds that there's like a corpse, something floating in the water. He doesn't know what this is. He pulls again, and he finds that it's a woman. And, you know, it's all very suspicious. He tells her, he asks her what she's doing there. She doesn't make any move to come on board. He turns around, gets his binoculars to kind of look at the other ship in the bay to see where she could have come from. And as he turns around, onto his ship comes this woman. And all she says to him is, "Hide me." And the next day, as he's hiding her in his cabin, the captain of the other ship comes on board and starts looking with his crew all over the ship. And our young captain races on board, wakes up and gets to see him and says, "You know, what are you doing on my ship? How did you get on board? You know, what are you doing here?" And the other captain says, "We're looking for a murderer. We better examine the whole ship, search it, and your cabin in particular." That's the setup.
I can't wait to see the film. It's tomorrow night at Carnegie Mellon University, McConomy Hall, and it will screen at 7:15 in the evening. Our guest has been Peter Fudukowski. He's the director of the film and an Oscar winner for producing the best foreign film in 2006. I wish we had more time, but it was so nice to get you here in our studios to talk. Good luck with the film, and thank you so much for coming to Pittsburgh and to Essential Pittsburgh today.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me onto your show.
Coming up, the Pitt women's basketball team is heading to the NCAA tournament. The Panthers have a first-round game tomorrow morning. We'll talk with head coach Susie McConnell-Cirio. And later, what is the economic impact of the NCAA men's tournament regional games being played in Pittsburgh? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The University of Pittsburgh women's basketball team has earned its first NCAA tournament bid since 2009. The Panthers are a number 10 seed and will play 7th-seeded Chattanooga of the Southern Conference at 11 a.m. tomorrow in the first round in Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm joined now by phone by Pitt head coach Susie McConnell-Cirio. Coach, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh and congratulations.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate it. We are so excited to have this opportunity, this challenge ahead of us. Our players are thrilled to be here.
The Panthers were the 62nd member of the 64-team field announced Monday night on that nerve-wracking ESPN selection show. But, you know, you weren't sweating it out or anything like that, were you?
Oh, my. If you would have seen the pictures from us waiting, I mean, what a stressful time. And Kara Lawson, who I know well, just texted me the next day, you know, talked to me, congratulating us. And, you know, I said, really? You had to make us wait till the second of the last game? And the three of the four teams knew that they were going to be in the field because they had won their conference. Tennessee knew they were going to be a two seed. And she just, her comment was, "We just love to create drama." Well, you got it. Because, you know, it was nerve-wracking. We had seen teams within our conference. Every team that Charlie Cream had predicted to be in was in the tournament, and then they finally get to us. But we could not have scripted it any better. The reaction was priceless. The video that we watched that was taken, the pictures that were taken, looking at that stuff never gets old. And it just reminds our players of the excitement and the energy that is surrounding our program right now.
In the process leading up to that, because I think it was like 40 minutes before they finally showed a bracket with the Pitt Panthers name in there, did you have any flashbacks to 2013 when you were coaching the Duquesne Dukes and you were projected to make the field but were left out of the pairings?
Absolutely. It was like that situation all over again, sitting there waiting. But looking back, I knew we had a shot to be in it here because of the paperwork that the NCAA sends you leading up to it. So I knew we were in consideration this season. But I did have a flashback, like, not again. And I actually stood up after I think the second bracket was announced, and I said, if we don't get in, I am never having a viewing again of watching this election show, because it was just the longest hour of my life. It was the longest week after we had lost in the ACC tournament. You know, we knew that we became a consideration to be a bubble team, per se. So it was the longest week of my life. We were on spring break. We weren't practicing that much until Thursday. But what a moment. I mean, our players will never forget it. It was so special. It's something that we will all always remember. And it's my first time as a coach. I've been there as a player, but never as a coach. So I'm looking forward to this opportunity.
I was going to ask you, you played in four NCAA tournaments as a player at Penn State. This is your first time going to the big dance as a coach. So how does it compare?
You know, as a player, I didn't know what to expect. And then once you're in your first NCAA tournament, and back then they did similar to what they're doing now, where you play on a home, and I think like 32 teams got in back then. So you were playing on the higher seeds team. So we had some home games. It was more like on home sites. I think this time you're going to have more feel of NCAA tournament, especially going to Tennessee, which I've said, you know, we couldn't have picked ourselves a better place to go, because knowing the Tennessee program and the history, that when they do something, that they're going to do it first class. And the Hall of Fame, the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame, is right in the same parking lot as the Marriott we're staying at. So we're going to have our players tour that and have the opportunity to do that. So it's going to be an incredible experience for our players.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Pitt head coach Susie McConnell-Cirio. The Pitt women's basketball team is headed to the NCAA tournament, and they play their first round game at 11 a.m. tomorrow in Knoxville, Tennessee, against Chattanooga. 11 a.m. tip-off. Isn't that a little early?
You know what? It's perfect for us, because on Saturdays, that's exactly the time that we practice. Now I know that we're just starting at 11, so that's all warming up and getting ready. But, you know, sometimes we've had 10 o'clock practices, 11 o'clock practices on Saturday. So our players are used to getting up and getting ready for practice. So honestly, the longest days are game days when we play evenings at 7 p.m. I prefer 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock game starts, because it seems like you wait all day. I mean, I'm going to be honest, my favorite days throughout the basketball season are game days. And for us to be able to just get up, eat breakfast, and go to the game and play, I couldn't have picked a better game time. Now, I hope our players feel that way and we go out and we play well and perform like we're capable of, and what I've seen us be able to do.
This is just your second year as the head coach at Pitt. Did you think it would happen this soon, making it to the NCAA tournament?
Honestly, I did not. I think when this year started and we started having practices and we saw our players, and we were so different as a team, just the whole demeanor, the whole work ethic. It started in the summertime when we finally got our freshmen on campus. So we were playing good teams, and I think the success I think we had, our players just got motivated and focused and hungrier to have that success every time we stepped out on the floor. And then we got into ACC, and you know, we're thrown into the fire right away with Louisville, and we had the chance to beat them on our home floor the first game. We beat North Carolina at home. So when we started to win, then you start thinking, oh my, can we really do this? And, you know, it wasn't anything that you thought about early, but as the season went along, is this a possibility really crosses your mind?
And is this a building block for your program? How much does it help in terms of recruiting and making Pitt a power in women's basketball?
Well, I think that remains to be seen, because of the five players that we signed for next year were signed before our season even started. So now you're looking at the next class, and, you know, the players that we're involved in, you know, you're hearing from them, their families, and the excitement of us being in the NCAA tournament. Now the younger players are taking even more notice of the success that we have. But, you know, we will be completely different next year. When you talk about losing Brianna Kiesel as your point guard, your leader, your do-everything. I mean, she was a scorer, playmaker, shooter, dictated the tempo defensively. You know, when you lose someone like that, you're losing a big part of your program. And she will be difficult to replace. And we'll be young. We'll lose three seniors. We don't have a junior on the roster. And, so we're built on freshmen and sophomores. And two juniors. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how we come back and how we develop as a team without her.
How much does this mean to the seniors on your team, especially a star player like Brianna Kiesel?
It means the world to them and for me. And one thing I did is I promised her that her senior year would be special. And it was more so about what we would do with her, the type of year that she would have, the players that we were surrounding her with. You know, not knowing this is the type of success that we had, but these players, the freshmen have come in and really have exceeded expectations. Monica Wignott, you know, having played volleyball here for 4 years now in our starting lineup, and the impact that she has had on our team, the chemistry that our players have developed really has been the key to our success. I mean, they are genuinely happy for each other on and off the floor. They get along, and that has really led to the success that we have had as a team.
And for someone like you, Susie, who has accomplished so much in this game of basketball, you won a gold medal in the Olympics, you've been to the NCAA tournament, you've been in the WNBA. How does this compare? Where does this rack among, where does this stack up among the accomplishments that you've racked up over the years?
You know, a lot of success that I've had has been as a player. And, you know, I've enjoyed the game of basketball and it has given me so many opportunities to play at a high level, to play with some of the best players. When you think about athletics and you think about playing college sports, is every team, the dream is to be in the NCAA tournament. So as far as a coach, you know, this is the ultimate.
We've been talking with Pitt head coach Susie McConnell Cirio. Her Pitt Panthers are headed to the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. They play 7th-seeded Chattanooga of the Southern Conference tomorrow, 11 a.m. tip-off. Coach McConnell Cirio, it has been a pleasure talking with you. Congratulations and good luck in the tournament.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. And despite not having a professional basketball team in Pittsburgh, Hoops is expected to bring big bucks to the city this weekend during the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Championships at CONSOL Energy Center. Those games got underway yesterday, and they continue this weekend. I'm joined now by phone by Visit Pittsburgh CEO Craig Davis to assess the economic impact of the NCAA tournament in Pittsburgh. Craig Davis, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thanks so much for having me on.
The timing of this, it's March and the weather's not particularly good and there may not be reasons to travel at this time of year, except if you're a sports fan, you're not going to let a few snowflakes stop you from getting to your destination. Having Pittsburgh as one of the destinations for NCAA basketball fans, what is that doing for the city, especially at this time of year economically?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. You know, it for us, we call this forced tourism. You have to go to the place where the event is taking place that you want to see. So as you kind of alluded to, Pittsburgh does very well for tourism throughout the year. But as you can suspect, the first 3 months of any year, January, February, March in the Northeast, are very tough. And so for us to have this particular event in March is a gift.
And how much money are we talking here? I mean, how much of a in terms of dollars and cents, is this a boost to the economy?
It is a huge boost to the economy. You know, conservatively right now, we've pegged this at about $7.1 million of direct spending that will take place in this city as a result of the games. But that is conservative in that we don't know. When we did the actual calculation, we had no idea which of the teams would end up actually playing in Pittsburgh. So my guess is, because of the quality of the teams that we have playing, that we're going to exceed that number. And the way that we'll be able to see that number is to see what's left over afterwards. And there are certain statistics that we will follow after the fact to be able to determine what the actual spend was.
And that's an interesting point, because it's not just that you're having the games here or the teams that are coming with their fan bases, but it's also, as they say, which teams travel well, which, you know, getting the teams that have the fans who follow them. So you must have been pretty happy when you saw that Notre Dame was going to be playing here.
there was a collected sigh of relief. You know, I've been doing this in this community for about 22 years, and I was on the hotel side, and we've been through a number of these events in my past, and I remember a couple of times when we just got a bunch of no-name colleges, which was great to have, but boy, you really saw the effect of that, as opposed to when Villanova and Notre Dame are announced. You know that their fans are going to find tickets, and they're going to find their way here.
Yeah, I forgot. I should have mentioned Villanova too, but you know, since they're such a rival of Pitt, you know, it's kind of hard to say the name. But yeah, the Wildcats are here, and unfortunately, the Panthers are not. Would it have made a difference if there had been a local team? You know, Robert Morris is in the tournament, but they are playing Duke down south. If there had been a local team, would that have helped or not made much difference?
Well, it's an interesting thing to actually ponder. If it had been a local team, selfishly speaking, there wouldn't have been a lot of need for hotel rooms. And that's, you know, Visit Pittsburgh, our whole mission is to create economic development, and a big part of that is through overnight stays. So if our fan base is in the city proper, there's likelihood that they wouldn't be staying in the hotels. But that doesn't account for the potential Pitt fans or Duquesne fans that would be from out of town coming in to see their team. So, you know, there's I would tell you, though, that to have a team like Notre Dame with their cross-section of fans across the world, that was probably what set us into a very, very positive direction, though.
So in addition to hotel rooms, what else are people spending their money on?
Anything that you would count on a typical game day experience. You know, if you look at the people that travel in from outside, they're staying in a hotel where they're going to need three meals a day plus all the other things that they would spend. But people even from in town, they're going to buy parking, they're going to buy souvenirs, they're going to buy a hot dog, they're going to utilize services and buy products that would be typical of the game day experience. You go down to the Strip District right now, I'm quite sure that the Strip District has for sale all the NCAA stuff that you could possibly want. So that's very much a part of how this calculation is made.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but is this the first time, I believe this is the first time that the CONSOL Energy Center has hosted games?
Yes, it is. I could be, you know, you caught me on that one because they were here a few years ago. It could have been the first year of CONSOL.
Yep, you know, actually in 2012 there were second
and
third round
games.
Yeah,
there was. You know,
so,
I apologize for not knowing that off the top of my head.
Yes,
no, this is the second time. And by the way, CONSOL has really opened up an opportunity for us to go after these types of tournaments and other amateur and professional types of tournaments that we really couldn't have done with the Civic Arena before. So for us, this is a really big deal to have a facility of this quality in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
So with about 30 seconds or so left, what will you be doing this weekend? You know, what are the different things that are tied to this tournament that you'll be making your way into and out of?
Well, you know, the thing is that Pittsburgh continues to get these tournaments because of what we do for them while they're here. So the entire city is, of course, welcoming everybody with open arms and has a lot of just game day specials and that kind of thing. In fact, I've heard, and I don't know if it's substantiated or not, but a couple of people said this morning that a couple bars and restaurants around the CONSOL have actually ran out of alcohol. Came close to running out of alcohol. That, to me, is a bellwether for a successful event.
I think that's...
So I'm going to be watching things and taking part.
I think that says it all, Craig.
It does say it all. That's what we're here to do, is have people spend a lot of money.
And have a good time doing it. Visit Pittsburgh CEO Craig Davis joining us by phone, talking about the economic impact of the NCAA men's basketball tournament in Pittsburgh. Craig, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
And thank you for listening to today's edition of Essential Pittsburgh. If you missed any portion of the show, go to our website and check out past segments at WESA.FM. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everybody.